And feature continues here on CKLN, and here's today's edition.
Welcome to the International Connection. I'm Bob Marshall. Today we will continue Dr. Beter's explanation of the Battle of the Harvest Moon in 1977. In a news conference on October 4th, 1977, Secretary of Defense Harold Brown shocked reporters by saying, quote, "There is a fact of Soviet anti-satellite operational capability," unquote. This was a vacation in September on the 20th of a U.S. spy satellite. But Brown did not explain that Russia's killer satellites, called Cosmos Interceptors, were manned and fired particle beam weapons. Reporters were left to assume that a 10-year-old explosive satellite design was still in use. There were now 8 Cosmos Interceptors in orbit, up from 2 in September. They were blasting U.S. spy satellites one by one, turning each into a fireball in space, like that seen on September 20th. On October 13th, CBS Radio News reported that several fireballs had been seen over Russia. But the biggest fireball of all took place on October 18th over the United States. The huge fireball was seen all the way from the McDonald Observatory in southwest Texas, northeastward into the Midwest. It was the 85 American space station Skylab, destroyed by a Russian Cosmos interceptor to prevent any American manned re-entry into space. Now a NASA cover-up was underway, starting with the October 27th announcement that Skylab's orbit was sinking sooner than expected and that it may come down prematurely. The Soviet Union had wasted no time in following up on its victory over the United States in the Battle of the Harvest Moon in space on September 27, 1977. On September 29th, the Salyut 6 space station was launched into orbit and Russia's manned space program suddenly came to life. Meanwhile, that same day, an American Atlas Centaur rocket exploded on its way toward orbit. The next day, NASA Houston radioed commands to automated equipment at the now-dead moon base to shut down. While America's manned moon era had just ended, Russia's had just begun. Soyuz 25, with 2 cosmonauts aboard, was launched on October 9th from the Baikonur Cosmodrome. Officially, it landed 2 days later. But in fact, Soyuz 25 had joined with a special booster package and was on the way to the moon. Cosmonauts Kovalenok and Ryumin became the first men to land on the far side of the moon on October 16, 1977. They and additional cosmonauts who had arrived since were fast assembling particle beam weapons which would soon be moved to the near side of the moon to be aimed at the Earth. By late September, swarms of Soviet submarines had been dispatched toward the United States to be ready for war after Russia's decisive space victory in the Battle of the Harvest Moon. On October 5th, Vice Admiral William Reed, commander of the Atlantic Fleet Naval Surface Forces, said at a symposium in Atlanta that Soviet subs and surface ships were present in great numbers along our Atlantic and Gulf coasts. The next day, a local radio station in San Diego reported that a naval spokesman had stated large numbers of Soviet subs were heading across the Pacific toward the United States. By October 9th, the Pacific subs were on station along our west coast, and some began injecting a plutonium-zirconium compound into our atmosphere for radiochemical warfare, as done a year ago. That day, British Foreign Minister David Owen left London for a sudden, unexpected 2-day trip to Moscow. On October 10th, with the crisis still deepening, Vice President Mondale was called back to Washington from a scheduled Columbus Day parade appearance in San Francisco. The peak war threat existed on October 12, 1977. All sub-fleets were on station, poised for attack. There were news reports of a new rash of fireball sightings over Russia. Secretary of Defense Brown, in Europe for NATO talks, left for Yugoslavia. He may have been the, quote, high U.S. official, unquote, who conveyed U.S. capitulation to Russia on October 14, 1977. On October 15th, the Soviet acceptance of the secret surrender agreement was signaled by the fact that the Soviet subfleets turned away from our shores and headed back toward their bases in the Soviet Union and Cuba. But 12 subs remained on station to continue spewing radiochemical warfare agents into our air. This is the source of the increasing rash of Legionnaire's disease that was showing up nationwide, as well as the unusually severe outbreaks of croup among small children reported recently in the northern United States. The Center for Disease Control in Atlanta now reports outbreaks of Legionnaire's disease in 22 states. That was in October 77. By means of this spreading, quote, atomic plague, unquote, the Soviet Union was trying to ensure that America's ability and will to fight was undermined. and that the secret surrender agreement of October 14th by the Carter administration was carried out. On September 29th, President Carter had told reporters that there was no prospect of an immediate SALT II agreement. The White House was still reeling from the disastrous American loss of the space battle of 2 days earlier and Gromyko's nighttime ultimatum at the White House. But this month, in October 77, the SALT II atmosphere had changed radically. The United States secret surrender of October 14th consisted of acceptance of Soviet demands for a new SALT II that would disarm America unilaterally. The only Soviet concession was to give Carter more time to start conditioning the American public to accept it. On October 19, 1977, major statements hinting at the new situation were made in a UN committee. The Russian delegate spoke of proceeding with, quote, drastic disarmament measures, unquote, while the American delegate spoke of a, quote, new sense of vigor and urgency, unquote, as part of a, quote, fundamental shift, unquote, in disarmament thinking. The next day, the nature of this fundamental shift began to be revealed as SALT II details started leaking publicly. It contained concessions by the United States, but none by the USSR. And it said nothing at all about radiochemical warfare or satellite killers or beam weapons, all of which were in operational use now by Russia. Having finally gained the upper hand, Russia's rulers intended to use SALT II to disarm America and then make sure America never rose again. That's the International Connection for today. I'll be back next Thursday.
Oh, I have a brief weather update for you. It's going to be sunny with cloudy periods today, the high getting up to 15. Cloudy this afternoon with a chance of showers or thunderstorms. Also brisk southwest winds gusting up to 50 kilometers per hour. Partial clearing tonight, the low dropping down to minus 3. For Friday, it will be cloudy and much colder, the high only reaching 4. We have no happy stories from listeners so far, but we have some happy stories from around the station, don't we, Dave?
Sure we do.
First of all, the station manager, Anton, is defecting to the United States on Saturday for 1 week. We're really happy about that because it's good for him to go away, but also we're unhappy because we'll miss him, but we're happy for him because he'll be happy there.
That's
and
right.
Another one, Christine Swiderski is doing her laundry tonight. She's really happy about that, she says. And Dave, how about you?
Oh, I'm happy in general.
Yeah, me too. I'm really happy.
Things are going well.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's happy.
Oh, boy, and here's the man who caused all these problems.
Les Allure is happy.
I'm so happy it's Christmas.
It's not.
Yes, it is.
No.
I was walking
it's
around
It's All Souls Day.
No,
All Saints Day. When was it?
All Souls Day.
It's All Saints Day today.
It's Christmas.
Les is a saint.
And
oh, boy. All right, are we finished? Yes, on Movie Time today, Mikey C. reviews the new, vastly underrated Paramount Pictures release, Firstborn.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Thursday edition of Movie Time. I'm Michael C., your host. One of the least talked about but yet most overwhelming films currently playing around town is Paramount Pictures' Firstborn, starring Terry Garr, Corey Haim, and Peter Weller. Basically, Firstborn is a drama concerning a divorced middle-aged woman, her two children, and the new boyfriend in her life. It's a real-life scenario where the once loving and civilized household of a divorced woman and her kids is shattered by the intrusion of a heady, big-mouth loser new boyfriend. The film begins with your regular family setting, a nice house, good kids, age 16 and 11, a car in the driveway, and a really neat mom. The story slowly begins to change its tone and feeling, though, when the new boyfriend enters Terry Garr's life. Needless to say, the kids tend disliking to this guy, and yet mom is hopelessly in love with him. Reasoning for the kids' dislike of him becomes apparent when Jake, the eldest son, finds out that this guy is a drug dealer. He's selling coke and various other mood modifiers. Jake slowly sees the physical demise of his mother and the rest of the house happening all around him. You see, mom's becoming a coke freak and no longer has the effort or time to deal with the kids or the condition of the house. Jake and his younger brother begin to pressure mom about this new guy and their distrust of him, but to no avail. And slowly but surely, the children's social and school life begins.